Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today on the program, a look at the backlash currently taking place against partisan gerrymandering and voter suppression efforts. A 2018 Supreme Court decision stated that courts were not the proper venue to address gerrymandering. So it's turned to citizens themselves to advocate changes. And that's exactly what has happened in 2018 and continues with efforts this year as well. David Daley's book, Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy, looks at some interesting grassroots initiative petition efforts to undo partisan gerrymandering that was successful in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Missouri, and Utah, how Idaho expanded Medicaid, and how voting rights for former felons were restored in Florida and Alabama. Also, how voter suppression efforts in Kansas and North Dakota were countered as well. David Daley is a journalist and a senior fellow at Fair Vote. His journalism has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Slate, Washington Post, and New York Magazine. He's the author of one previous book on partisan gerrymandering, which I can't say on the radio. It begins with the word rat, and the second part of the word starts with the letter F. He's a former editor of Salon, and he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. David Daley, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In your book, Unrigged, you write that 2017 and 2018 were banner years for voter suppression. In 2017, 31 legislatures considered 99 bills that would make it more difficult to vote in the first few months of 2018. 24 states considered another 70 bills. But out of all those efforts and previous ways states have made it more difficult to vote, came a grassroots backlash. And your book profiles these efforts to expand voting rights in the face of these efforts to suppress it. You covered that a lot during the lead up to the 2018 midterm. What made you decide this was the issue to examine?
It's a good question. You know, I had written an earlier book about partisan gerrymandering, and that book in many ways was kind of all about how democracies die. And I didn't want to write another book about that. I wanted to talk about the citizens who were refusing to let a democracy die and who turned off cable news and logged off of Twitter and sort of got to work in their communities and in their states, pushing back against these big structural barriers that a lot of experts thought were too big and too high to ever do anything about. And they took on these really hard fights on these important structural issues, and they won. You know, it's not as if these issues were too confusing or too wonky or too boring for people. In many ways, all of these voting rights issues are about fairness. And Americans love fairness and hate cheating. And when we start to fight back against the politicians who would rig the system in their own favor, you begin to see these amazing majorities of Democrats, Republicans, Independents coming together to get things done.
Oftentimes when you see the initiative petition route, a lot of times it's AstroTurf grassroots efforts. It's groups that are masquerading as grassroots efforts. What you saw was oftentimes an AstroTurf grassroots effort competing with a real grassroots efforts, and it's the real grassroots efforts that actually got the issue on a ballot and saw it to victory.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I went out and spent a lot of time in Michigan, where, which is one of the most gerrymandered states in the country, in such a way that the Republicans have been able to hold on to the legislature there for the entire decade, even though the Democrats have won more votes every time. And so what that does is, not to be partisan about it, it allows legislators to act in unaccountable ways, knowing that they are insulated from the public. And you end up with more extreme legislation, and voters can't do anything about it. And you had a 27-year-old woman who posts on Facebook that she wants to do something about gerrymandering in Michigan. And that Facebook post is actually what leads to a group called Voters Not Politicians, and they collect 430,000 signatures by themselves. It's the first time that any initiative in Michigan has ever won its way to the ballot without paid signature collectors. They had more than 4,000 volunteers going out door to door and, you know, football games and fall festivals and anywhere you would find people. They had the Chamber of Commerce. They had the Boss family money lined up against them, and they still managed to knock that back every step of the way. And then they won in November with more than 62% of the vote. So Democrats, Republicans, and independents in Michigan came together and said, we don't want politicians drawing these lines anymore and choosing their own voters. We think we can do a better job of this ourselves.
Well, the book begins actually with second chance voting, and you begin by telling the story of a young woman in Alabama who, at age 17, before she's even eligible to vote, she is out with friends. They're smoking marijuana. A local law enforcement officer comes by. He has a lot of discretion, but he decides to charge these young people with a felony in Alabama, and it is a felony that involves moral turpitude. And in Alabama at the time, this made this a very special felony in which you would never get your voting rights back. This is a young woman at 17 who's convicted of marijuana possession, and she had lost her voting rights before she was even ever able to exercise them. And you begin with this story about Alabama's prohibition against felons voting. It seems particularly egregious.
I was really moved by that example. I mean, when you're 17 years old and you make a mistake that lots of people have made, it doesn't seem like you ought to lose your civic voice forever as a result before you've even been able to use it. And when you go back and you look at moral turpitude, it's amazing because it is worked into Alabama's state constitution in the years after the Civil War. The states, as a condition of coming back into the Union, had to ratify the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that essentially extended suffrage and citizenship to former slaves. And the states in their state constitutions found a way around this by coming up with all of these voting restrictions like moral turpitude. And they would say, okay, you can vote as long as you don't commit a crime involving moral turpitude. And then they would define moral turpitude in such a way as to have it be the kind of thing that would trip up a black person and not a white person. And this kind of structural racism was built into the constitutions of these states. And 130 years later, it ensnares this young woman. It's deeply unfair. I mean, the white Speaker of the House in Alabama was convicted of all kinds of bribery and malfeasance charges. That did not come with moral turpitude. So he is able to continue voting. But this 17-year-old woman who takes a couple puffs on a joint loses her voting rights forever. This is the kind of thing that has to stop.
Now, eventually, Alabama did liberalize what crimes voting prohibitions pertains to really very serious crimes. But then they basically tried to suppress the fact that they'd actually changed the law. So this young woman, they changed the law. She still thought she had lost her voting rights in perpetuity.
Yeah, you know, and I think that this is so important as we head toward 2020, right? And an election in which we're probably going to be conducting a lot of it by mail, and there's going to be a lot of new things that haven't been done, and, you know, forms that have to be filled out, perhaps applications that have to be sent in advance, or it's going to be harder to register to vote if you're a young person. These are all barriers to the vote that stand in front of people, and it can be deeply unfair. The Secretary of State in Alabama, after the legislature, essentially under court order, goes ahead and ends moral turpitude, he simply decides that he is not even going to print out the forms that would be necessary for people to go ahead and regain their voting rights. He's not even going to print them out. So volunteer nonprofits essentially come together and they create the forms and they put them up. And I joined with them, and we went door to door sort of looking for these people. And it was a really moving experience. But it is not easy to do because, I mean, if you look in Texas, there's a woman in jail right now, famously, for accidentally voting when she was out on probation. So if you are not sure if you can vote or not, you don't necessarily want to go ahead and take that risk. So states often, I would say deliberately, try to make it confusing and difficult. Mm-hmm. And voting ought to be easy.
My guest today is David Daly. He's a journalist and senior fellow at Fair Vote and the author of Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy, in which he writes about the grassroots backlash against voter suppression, and it involves a lot of number of states. Second chance voting involved Florida and a number of other states where felons who have completed their sentence are now able to vote. But there are other issues that you cover as well. The next one is also a great story, the Medicaid Express in Idaho. And it's hard to believe that Idaho Medicaid expansion began in a northern Idaho town of Sandpoint with a failed local school board election. How did this local election spur a statewide vote to expand Medicaid?
It's amazing. You had a couple of former students who came back to their hometown to try to help pass a school tax that would have kept public schools going up there. It became a controversial issue locally. It failed a couple times. And they realized that perhaps that they could come back and kind of help organize and storytell and door knock. And they won. They turned it around by kind of going out and meeting people and talking to them. They changed folks' minds on the, you know, value of paying for public education. And they kind of caught the political spirit. And they wanted to see what else they could do to help. And Idaho, legislators there for 6 years in a row had refused to expand Medicaid. So they were simply not taking the money that Idaho was sending to Washington. They weren't taking it back. And there were about 70,000 of their neighbors who were kind of falling in between that gap between the state exchanges and the Affordable Care Act.
By the way, we know all about this in Oklahoma, too.
Yeah, right.
It should be on the ballot in 2020 sometime.
I hope it makes it there in the middle of the pandemic, you know. But Idaho is very rural, you know. So you really need Medicaid in a state like that if you're going to provide health care. And what they did was that they took it to the initiative, and they won in this deeply red state, right? I mean, a state as red as Taylor Swift's lipstick. So this is a one-party state, but 14% Democratic. And they won at about 61-62% of the vote there. So you don't do that unless if you go out and persuade people. And it goes to show you that when legislators, whether it's in a gerrymandered state or whether it's a one-party state, elections become uncompetitive. Politicians don't have to be responsive to what people want to have done. And sometimes voters have to stand up and go around their own elected representatives. And that's what happened in Idaho.
What was really interesting about the Medicaid Express, they actually bought an old RV, painted it green with Medicaid expansion on the side of it. But what was really interesting about Idaho is, you know, the population center is in Boise. You couldn't just get the signatures in Boise. You have to get signatures in a vast majority of the state, or about half of the state, to qualify for the ballot. So that means, and Idaho is a big state, and it's rural and a lot of small communities. So they had to go all over the state and basically start collecting signatures.
The legislature did not make it easy to put anything on the ballot, and they've since made it even harder because politicians don't like it when citizens enact change in this way. But they had to qualify. I think they needed 10% of the voting of registered voters in 21 of 24 counties or something as serious as that. So they had to get out of Boise, and they had to drive that RV all the way around the state and collect signatures and talk to a lot of people. And I think that that's really what made it work. When you have to go out and door knock, when you have to meet all of these people and convince them and persuade them, you've got to go out and talk to everybody. I mean, I spent a day with them in Idaho Falls, out in the kind of far eastern corner of the state. It's a very conservative Mormon town. And we knocked on a door, walked up the driveway, and there's a bumper sticker in the driveway that reads, "Vietnam, we were winning when I left." And I'm thinking, maybe this isn't going to be the most fruitful house. Perhaps we ought to go find another place. We were winning the Vietnam War when this guy was there. He might not want to talk to us about Medicaid expansion. And the volunteers, they march up the driveway as if they don't even notice this. The guy comes to the door and he says, "Yeah, you know, we fall in that same gap. I get it. I'm with you. I'm going to vote for this." So it goes to show you, right, that you just can't prejudge people's politics. You can still go out and talk to your neighbors and make change, and maybe we are not as divided as we think.
I want to ask you, a large part of the book hinges on state grassroots efforts to undo gerrymandering, which is one of the, perhaps one of the reasons why an issue can have a majority within the state supporting it, but whatever the power structure of the ruling of that state goes against it, they're not going to vote for it, even though it might be popular because, again, gerrymandering helps protect those incumbents. And so a large part of the book hinges on these efforts to undo gerrymandering, and you alluded to efforts in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Missouri. And before we talk about one state in particular, a lot of this is all tied to a Supreme Court case that most people probably have never heard of, Common Cause versus Rucho. Why is this case important?
This is a case in which, 2018, the Supreme Court of the United States, in a closely contested 5-4 decision, they essentially closed the federal courthouses to claims of partisan gerrymandering. They said that partisan gerrymandering was a non-justiciable political issue. And at almost exactly the moment that the federal courts around the country, consisting of judges appointed by Democratic and Republican presidents, were beginning to sort of understand the importance and the urgency of the courts weighing in on these extreme gerrymanders and policing politicians from going too far in drawing themselves friendly lines, and also believing that they had the tools to enforce this in a nonpartisan and clear way. And the Supreme Court put an end to this and, you know, in a 5-4 vote that I think we will probably rue for a long time in this nation, especially as we head towards the 2020 census and the next round of redistricting, in which these politicians could be free again to just go hog wild.
Now, in the book, you detail efforts in a number of states. We already talked a little bit about Michigan, but I'd like to focus on Utah. Utah, like Oklahoma, is a reliably one-party state. And at first glance, people would say, well, why does, you know, a gerrymandered district really matter in a state where most of the citizens belong to one political party or one vote that way, at least in Oklahoma? And, for example, in Utah, it is an overwhelmingly Republican state. Yet voters in Utah buck the long odds of even getting a redistricting initiative petition on the ballot, then narrowly passed it. Why did it matter to Utah, where you think of it as very much a red state, reliably Republican? Why does it matter?
I think it matters because it affects your ability to represent towns. I went out and spent, you know, a long time in Utah because I was fascinated by this for exactly those reasons. And you would go to these towns in Utah that were divided up into 3 or 4 different districts in their state legislature. And you would just be like, why is this possibly the case? And it was always done in order to entrench one incumbent lawmaker or another in office. So if you live in those towns, you might not even know who to go to if you've got a problem. And if you live in those towns, the lines are drawn not to represent you, but to ensure that a specific person wins. And that takes away from all of our voices. It takes away from the power and value of our votes. And then I would say one other thing is that even if it's a one-party state, when you have that level of gerrymandering, it creates non-competitive districts in which no one wants to run in the November election because the results are foreordained. And it means that the only competitive election oftentimes is in the primary. And primary elections, as we know, are held during summer months, or sometimes it's lower turnout, and they tend to be base elections, right? The most devoted piece of the party, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, is going to come out and bother voting at that time in an election like that. So it pushes up winners to the extreme, but it also makes politicians who win, they're most afraid of losing a primary challenge. So when they go to Oklahoma City or when they go to Washington, they behave in such a way as to try to hold off anybody from the left or the right running against them in a primary, which means they're less willing to strike a compromise or seek consensus or work with someone across the aisle.
And in fact, in Utah, that was what you heard, was that you heard citizens bemoaning the hyper-partisanship and hoping that maybe even though a Republican was likely to win in a general election, it would the fact that if you nominated a hyper-partisan, it might make the seat in play. And the other thing in Utah was the idea that you had a single community that sort of has a community value represented right by three or four different people.
That's exactly right. And when that happens, the values get split and they get pushed to extremes, and citizens don't fundamentally feel represented. I think that these voters in Utah also very much wanted to send a message, I think, to the rest of the country. I think they wanted to say, hey, if one party Republican Utah can find a way to fix this, hey, how about you, Massachusetts? And, how about you, New Jersey? Let's find a way, red states, blue states, to come together and show that we are serious about fixing this.
And what's really interesting about a lot of the work that these redistricting initiatives do, they put them into a nonpartisan sphere where you actually spend a little time about how the mathematicians can really show how a set of lines have been partisanly gerrymandered just through running computer applications that show you if you move a line a little bit, you can show how it protects an incumbent or not. This is not really difficult to get nonpartisan district lines in place if a community has the will to do it.
It is not that difficult to do, and we've gotten really good at figuring out how to pull some of the politics back. You're never going to make anything free of politics, but you can create a process that works better than allowing a bunch of politicians to go into a back room and do it all themselves. The way most of these commissions work is you've got, five Democrats, five Republicans, five independents, and they have to hold public hearings around the state. They have to go off and they have to listen to people about which communities ought to be held together and what a community of interest is, what the values are and what the economic interests might be. And then when they go to draw, they're drawing in public, so it's completely transparent. But you've got to have a map that wins a supermajority of Democrats, Republicans, and independents in order to pass. A map can't pass 8-7 in most of these new commission states. The Democrats and independents can't team up on the Republicans and jam a map through. You've got to have everybody sign off on it. And in a way, it really mirrors what a lot of us, I think, wish our politics were like. You know, you give people a problem. How do you draw these districts in a fair way? And they go off and they work together on it, and they come back with perhaps not a perfect solution, but they come back with a solution that everybody can agree on. And, I mean, imagine the kinds of politics we could have if our politicians actually function that way.
My guest today is David Daley. He's a journalist and senior fellow at Fair Vote. His book is titled Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. One quick last question, and the book is really full of really interesting stories of how grassroots activists expanded voting rights in a number of states. But I do have to ask your reaction to the Wisconsin primary elections, which happened a couple of weeks ago, the legislature forcing people to brave a pandemic to vote in person. And of course, now 2 weeks later, we're beginning to see a big jump in coronavirus cases in Wisconsin. That surge is happening at 2 weeks after the election. What were your thoughts on that?
I found it, frankly, horrifying. And, I mean, that decision had its roots in gerrymandering. Wisconsin is one of the most gerrymandered states in the nation. And Republicans in the legislature were trying to force that vote because they wanted to protect a Supreme Court justice who was on the ballot that day. And the sense was that, you know, a lower turnout rate might help that justice get through. But really what I think Wisconsin shows us is that this is what we have to avoid in November. Wisconsin, it was a mess. You've got Americans standing in line in masks, socially distanced. In Milwaukee, they were only able to open 5 of 180 polling places. You had a post office that was overwhelmed, that could not deliver all of the ballots in time. I mean, after the election, they were finding boxes of ballots stacked up in post offices. You had the state in court the day before an election trying to hold it off. Can you imagine if this is the case in November?
Yeah.
We've got less than 200 days before the presidential election. We've got to be thinking now, and we've got to be thinking about this in a nonpartisan way. How can we ensure that every state has got systems in place that allow Americans to vote freely, fairly, safely, and securely?
David Daley, thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Daley is a journalist and a senior fellow at Fair Vote. His new book is titled Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. It's published by Live Right. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thanks for listening.